There's apparently another type of foul play at work in the food world, olive oil fraud. A new study from the University of California at Davis claims more than two-thirds of random samples of imported extra virgin olive oil don't meet the extra virgin standard. From Capital Public Radio, Elaine Korn reports.
The Olive Oil Chemistry Lab is on the Davis campus. It overlooks many of the campus's 2,000 olive trees. Managing the lab's olive oil forensics is chemist Charles Shoemaker.
We have our own CSI olive oil lab here.
To be extra virgin, it can't be rancid, adulterated with cheap refined olive oil, or doctored up, cut, with lesser oils. Shoemaker wasn't all that surprised that many of the 14 major brands tested failed certain tests.
It's become a very sophisticated practice, the adulteration of olive oil throughout the world.
The lab says it can prove defects, degradation, and dilution in olive oil beyond what human taste buds can figure out. Shoemaker zeroes in on specific flaws.
We do spectroscopic studies looking for oxidation.
That means the oil's old or rancid. Shoemaker also tests fatty acids.
To make sure the oil is all from olives and not from soybean, sunflower, or other types of oils.
No molecule can hide. Shoemaker revs up a small vacuum. It removes solvents and isolates chlorophyll, which is always an oil made from green olives, but never in lesser grade seed oil. As it sucks a sample, he's patient.
It takes about 25 minutes per sample to do just this one step.
The UC Davis study was funded in part by the California Olive Oil Council. Oils were tested by some methods not yet recognized by international standards, and for that reason, Bob Bauer of the North American Olive Oil Association, which represents importers, disputes the Davis study.
It's irresponsible to create the misperception that they've done based on unrecognized tests. These results directly contradict our 20 years of more extensive sampling and what those results show.
There's never been a legal definition in the U.S. for any grade of olive oil. Mounting concern over truth in olive oil labeling has drawn in the USDA. New American regulations will conform to international standards. Olive oil from every olive oil producing country, including America, will be subject to random sampling off retail shelves starting in October, using a lab in Georgia. For NPR News, I'm Elaine Korn in Sacramento.
This is NPR News.
In this country, the price of fancy cheeses, pastas, and wines from Europe are all affected by the value of the dollar relative to the euro. The euro dropped to its lowest level in 4 years this spring, but it's been climbing recently. The European currency is trading today at about $1.30, up significantly from just a few weeks ago when it was around $1.20. NPR's Anthony Brooks reports on the impact at a food store.
At Formaggio Kitchen in Cambridge, Mass., owner Isan Gerdal offers specialty foods from all over Europe.
Cheeses, oils, vinegars, pastas, chocolates, you name it.
And all for a pretty steep price. But of course, that has a lot to do with the value of the euro.
It's been quite a challenge. And when dollars started losing against the euro, we got hit kind of a double whammy. Not only it was costing us more to buy European goods, the Europeans raised their prices.
That's because the Chinese were importing large quantities of European milk, which pushed up the prices of European cheeses. At the same time, less than positive economic news here in the U.S. pulled down the value of the dollar. It's a complicated set of forces that requires some sophisticated strategies for small business owners like Isan Gerdal.
What we did is started to monitor the euro almost daily. And whenever we saw a little drop, we would purchase futures or bid, you know, a large amount of money and try to fix a price.
So when the euro hit historic lows against the dollar, Gerdal contracted to buy about $300,000 worth of foods at that low exchange rate, in effect gambling that the euro wouldn't continue to fall. He says he's lost big money trying to hedge against currency fluctuations like this. But this last time, the strategy worked and allowed him to bring some of his prices down.
The things that we could pass the savings on were things that we're bringing every week. you know, the mountain cheeses, the fresh goat cheeses that comes from France, England, Belgium, things that I know that I have a stronger dollar on, and I bought futures for it.
As for what to expect in the coming months, Brian Bethune, an economist for IHS Global Insight outside of Boston, says more of the same, which means more volatility.
In fact, the euro was as high as 151 and was as low as 120. We're probably going to see the euro rebound for a period of time here, but as you get towards the end of this year, it'll probably start to track down again.
But back at Formaggio Kitchen in Cambridge, these price fluctuations don't really seem to matter to customers like Jean Fetchheimer and Judith Levine.
Well, I can honestly tell you that I would never notice, because when I come here to get things, I'm not being a very prudent, cost-conscious shopper.
I buy cheese, I buy bread, salami, charcuterie, you know, those kinds of items. I do feel I'm contributing to the global economy.
But if variations in the value of the euro matter little to them, they matter a lot to small business owners like Isan Gerdal.
Did you think that you were going to have to sort of be a little bit of a macroeconomist to do a business like this?
No, I didn't. And but, you know, you kind of catch up quickly when you take some serious losses.
Gerdal says he feels pretty good about the future, at least until the next round of currency fluctuations. Anthony Brooks, NPR News, Cambridge.
This week, the federal government is reopening about a third of the Gulf waters that have been closed to commercial fishing. That doesn't mean commercial fishing will return to pre-spill levels. Many fishermen and their boats are working with BP in the cleanup effort, and the coastal waters, which provide some of the most productive fishing, are still closed. As NPR's Greg Allen reports, even after all the oil is gone, it will likely be years before the Gulf fishing industry is as productive as it once was.
Just a few miles from the Gulf, Franklin, Louisiana is a good location for oyster processing. It's on Highway 90, convenient to oyster beds both in Louisiana and in Texas to the west. Ameripure set up shop here in 1998. It's a company that pasteurizes oysters using a special process and then sells them shucked and on the half shell in California and other states that restrict raw seafood. Co-owner Pat Fahey says before the spill, business was good.
I'd come into this cooler and you'd have 40 pallets of sacks, oyster sacks. About 1,000 oyster sacks would be here on a typical Monday, 80 to 100,000 pounds.
Today, the cooler and others here at Ameripure are turned off, the doors propped open. The company laid off its 48 workers and shut down last month. With the closure of many oyster beds, Fahey says it became difficult to find enough product. But there's a bigger problem with oysters. In an effort to keep oil offshore, Louisiana diverted large amounts of fresh water from the Mississippi through passes and bayous. For the oyster beds, that was deadly. Oysters thrive in brackish water, a mixture of salt and fresh water. The state's working now to determine how many oysters the fresh water killed, but Fahey expects a large-scale die-off.
The fact of the matter is we've had tens of millions of gallons of water flushed into our estuaries since the end of April. Oysters just can't live in that.
In areas inundated by freshwater, Fahey says it will take 3 years, maybe more, before fishermen will be able to harvest oysters there. He's worried that could drive him out of business, though for now he and his employees are getting checks from BP. Scientists are just beginning to study the impact the BP spill is having on the ecosystems within the Gulf, from estuaries to deep-sea coral reefs. But marine biologist Wes Tunnell already has some idea of what to expect. He's studied the impact of a similar Gulf oil spill now for more than 30 years. In 1979, for 10 months, a blowout at the Yxtoc well dumped 10 to 30,000 barrels of oil a day into the Gulf, 60 miles off Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. 31 years later, Tunnell, a researcher at Texas A&M in Corpus Christi, says it's not hard to find areas still affected by the spill. Last month, he swam over a coral reef off the Mexican coast that he's monitored for years. He says there's still a mat there of weathered crude from the Yxtoc spill.
I picked up a chunk about 5 or 6 inches in diameter and broke it open, and it still had a sheen to it, and sure enough, it still had a pretty strong smell of petroleum, which surprised me.
Tunnell says there's also still weathered crude to be found in the area's mangroves, a tropical ecosystem similar to the marshes of Louisiana. These tidal wetland areas are the Gulf nurseries and the places most sensitive to pollution. He says even the relatively small amount of oil that so far has hit Louisiana's marshes is likely to have a significant impact.
90% of the species in the Gulf of Mexico rely on estuaries. Shrimp and crabs and oysters are tied very directly to their life cycles within that salt marsh area.
As for fishing, the best news might be that Tunnel and other researchers say they expect things to bounce back relatively quickly. Fish like tuna, snapper, and mackerel largely avoid oily or murky water. A bigger issue, though, is public perception of seafood coming from the Gulf. Gerald Horst is a retired fisheries expert at Louisiana State University, now the author of several seafood cookbooks. He's concerned about how that perception will affect the Gulf seafood industry and the people who live along the coast.
Families sitting down and eating crawfish and eating frog legs and etouffees, gumbos, creoles, stews, the fabric of our communities is so tightly knit and it's so intertwined with natural resource use that I really worry about the future.
NOAA is conducting an extensive seafood inspection campaign and says it will be reopening more fishing grounds as appropriate. But for shrimpers, fishermen, and processors along the Gulf Coast, before they begin rebuilding their industry, they may just have to rebuild their seafood brand. Greg Allen, NPR News.
At restaurants across the country, the dinner menu has been bleeding not so subtly onto the cocktail list. Brown butter rum, chorizo margaritas, foie gras brandy, and of course, bacon. In just about every combination you can think of. Bacon vodka, bacon bourbon, and here in Washington, D.C., bacon scotch. We wanted to learn more about this carnivorous trend in mixology, so we headed over to Proof, a restaurant just a few blocks from our studios. There, we met up with bar manager Adam Birnbach, and he gave us a little lesson in the art of fat washing.
Meat gives a cocktail a certain unique flavor that nothing else can give across. There is a comedy to it, I admit, but it's not so unnatural in a way. If you can infuse the rind of an orange, why not bacon?
I think we definitely have to taste. All right. Bacon-infused scotch. Oh! Okay, you know what's really strange about that? You smell bacon going in, and then bacon kind of, when you leave, it remains with you.
Mm-hmm.
How did you do this?
I merely took the fat that was strained off of cooking bacon.
Which is the fat that we all get when we cook bacon at home. And usually we put it in a little jar and put it, like, under the sink.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying you do something else with that little jar from under the sink.
What you can do is pour it into an alcohol. In this case, a very, very peaty scotch. A delicious peaty scotch. Put it into a freezer and it'll separate. The fat will separate. It'll look almost like the crema on espresso. You skim that off. What you have is the flavor tones of bacon, but under the oil.
Birnbach says the process can take hours or days, depending on the richness of the fat. But that's only the first step towards the real fun, making up new concoctions. Lesson number two, the Jamesy's breakfast cocktail. Birnbach pulls out a shaker and pours a little bit of brown liquid from a plastic container. That's the bacon scotch. Then he measures out the secret ingredient.
I think we can all agree that a little bit of sweetness goes very well with bacon. I personally like a little bit of maple syrup on mine, but in this case, I'm going to go a little bit more barbecue-y and go with molasses.
He portions out some lemon juice and then Grand Marnier. The result is a murky mix, the color of caramel, with a bright spiral of an orange rind perched on the edge of a martini glass.
I think the key is integration, and this is for cocktails in general. If everything can be integrated in a well-balanced and interesting manner, then you got yourself a good cocktail.
Oh my goodness. This is amazing. It's so strange. It really smells like a breakfast plate. Like, it smells like the bacon, and there's some fresh fruit on the side of the plate, and I don't know, waffles. I wish you had made one for yourself, and then we could have a little toast.
Oh, I still got the whole night ahead of me.
Oh, right. Adam Birnbach is the bar manager at Proof Restaurant in Washington, D.C. Adam, thanks for showing me how it's done.
Thank you very, very much for coming by and visiting.
Cheers.
Cheers.
And if you'd like to get Adam Birnbach's drink recipes, like the Jamesy's breakfast cocktail or his Minito with anchovy tequila, head over to our website at npr.org.